Hey everyone, welcome to episode 58 of the Talk on the Rocks podcast. I'm here with my co-host Jack. How's it going, buddy?
Doing good, man. Another good guest, another good episode.
Yeah, we're excited. It's nice to have somebody else in the Zoom call with us. So I'd like to welcome fellow Queens alumni like myself, the former running back of the Toronto Argos and currently the tournament director for the RBC Open, Brian Crawford, to the podcast. Welcome, Brian.
Hey guys, how's it going, Thomas? Jack, thanks for having me.
We're doing good. We can't complain. We got somebody on here to talk to you, so that's always a good thing. And we're excited to hear about some of your stories. We got some good questions lined up, so we're excited to get it going.
All right.
I guess just to break the ice, what year did you graduate? I mean, I went to Queens. Jack didn't go to Queens, but he spent quite a bit of time up there hanging out with me, so he's been there familiar enough. With Kingston and the city. What year did you graduate?
So Jack's an adopted Gale, I guess.
Yeah.
I own one sweater, so.
Oh, that's a good thing. Then you're like as good as any first year student at Queens. I was there 2001 through to 2005. So I spent 4 years there, but came back for an extra half semester after my first year in the CFL and did like finished a minor and that kind of stuff. And who became my wife was still there at the time. So I had reason to come back, and what else was I going to do in the off season of the CFL season? So I guess, technically I guess would be, six, but actually finished with a class of 05.
So I guess I graduated, Jack and I graduated in 2019. Yeah. what do you think the biggest change is if you were to go back and be in my cohort to when you were there?
Oh, well, definitely the student center. And I mean, you guys didn't have the opportunity to experience the PEC, in the dungeon that was the sport fitness facilities at Queens at the time. Although some alumni and I, we were on a call the other night reminiscing about the workout varsity room and what a dungeon it was. So that facility is pretty darn nice now. I don't think you guys got the full experience of homecoming, that I would have had when I was back there. And, it kind of culminated in the flipping of a car and the lighting on fire of a car. So that's not necessarily a good thing, but I don't know.
If you ask.
As I said, my wife, girlfriend at the time, but my wife now, so she's a Queens grad as well. They lived right on Johnson, and they had like an empty lot next to them. And I kid you not, three years out of three that they were living in that house, people camped on that empty lot, came up like from wherever, Western or whatever school, set up tents and like camped on that lot for homecoming.
That's Jesus. I lived on Johnson during my fourth year. I know they got, I think it's called Vic Park is up there, a big park there. So it doesn't surprise me that there'd be people sitting outside. There's only so much space, as Jack knows. There's only so much floor space in a college house. So
totally. Tent would have been better, I think. I should have brought a tent.
I had a house my second year. We had a house of 8 football players. And so that was rowdy, to say the least. And that house broke up after 1 year. It wasn't to be.
And the house literally broke in half.
Literally broke in half. And so we split up. So I was at Johnson and Alfred. And then we moved out our back door to Alfred and Johnson. And then we moved across town to Bagot, which was over on the other side of the park there. Which was a little classier, there were more grad students over there and, some bed and breakfast and stuff.
The part of downtown, not the student ghetto.
Yeah, we felt, we felt like we were classy in our fourth year.
It's funny to hear because I feel like some schools, you wouldn't just say like one street and know exactly where you are, but you just said all those places and it's like, oh, I definitely know exactly the area you're talking about. That's kind of cool. And then I guess you said, obviously, we know that you played football there. How was that experience? Was that like you went there for football or were you kind of a walk? I don't know how the football experience works when you go in.
Absolutely. I was recruited to come. I had the good fortune coming out of high school to get to see, a dozen or more schools across the country on recruiting trips. And it was a pretty fun, like January to April of my senior year of high school, just going to a different university every single weekend. So that was pretty good. Kingston was awesome. Queens was kind of it was pretty cool to think that I could go there and be part of that, that school and the history of the football program. And at the time, the football program was was had not been good. It was, I think, 1-7 the year before our recruiting class arrived, and had been in a pretty down time through the late 90s after winning the Vanier early in the 90s. So, you know, we kind of came in, but we had a really good team, and it was brand new coaching staff at the time, and turned that program around. We went 7-1 for a couple seasons and just couldn't get over McMaster in those years, lost in the Yates Cup to them and that kind of stuff. But, you know, really kind of, I think, was part of like setting Queens back on the right pathway. And, you know, eventually they won the Vanier Cup again in 09. So it was a great experience, really cool to, you know, be part of a football team and have, you know, instantly have, you know, 100 brothers that, you know, were part of your family that you spend the whole year with. And as I said, you know, I lived with football guys the whole time there, and you know, it was a lot of fun, and it was you know, definitely a special time. And I actually ran on the track team for my 4 years there, so kind of had a two sport experience in university. But you know, it was a lot of fun.
Was one of the other schools that you're considering or going on trips to, was it Mac?
You know, I'm a Hamilton guy. So born and bred Hamiltonian, but I really wanted to go away for school and get away from home, have that experience. Certainly considered Mac, went down for a visit, that kind of stuff. They were recruiting Jesse Lumpston at the time, and I was friends with Jesse. I had a lot of run-ins with him in high school too. Our two teams, you know, played each other quite a number of times. He was in Burlington, I was in Hamilton. So, you know, and I was a back. So I was like, you know, I'm going to probably go somewhere different than Jesse goes, is probably another good reason. And needless to say, that was probably a good decision. I'm sure I would have ended up switching positions or something, because he was fantastic in his university career. But I definitely wanted to get away. So, you know, looked at everything, you know, certainly Western was one, looked in the East Coast, all those schools, and in a variety of other places. But, you know, Queens was really kind of stood out.
Did Jesse ever reach out for you to hop in the bobsled with him? Am I thinking about the correct Jesse?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Jesse is still competing. I think he's going to take a shot at Beijing next year. Has had, you know, obviously he had a great university career. Heck, Crichton Trophy winner. Went on, had a, you know, a bit of an opportunity in the NFL, and then had, you know, a pretty good career in the CFL. Had some injury problems, unfortunately, that really derailed him. But transitioned out of his CFL career into the bobsled career, as you said. He's been to 3 Olympic Games. You know, he's competed in the Olympic Games representing Canada, which is pretty awesome, and has had a lot of success, and is a really just a fantastic guy too. So hopefully, you know, they can maybe grab a medal next year in China.
For sure. You said, obviously, it was a great experience for you. I'm just curious about what your thoughts are between the disparity between the OUA and the NCAA. So kind of the college in Canada versus the college sport in the States. Do you see kind of a rise in the OUA in the future? And what are the kind of steps that you think they have to take to get there? Like, is the disparity just based on funding, or where do you set the
pin
there?
You know, it's an interesting thing, right? We are neighbors with, you know, the world's Goliath, right? I mean, they have the largest economy, the most resources in everything and anything. And so, you know, we often are comparing ourselves to the United States, and it's really an unfair comparison, right? They are certainly, you know, the greatest superpower in so many ways, and sports is certainly one of them. You know, I have an interesting perspective on this, because I spent 8 years of my career working for the OUA and spent a couple years as the executive director there as well. So, you know, the reality is that the discrepancy, of course, between, you know, Alabama football and Queens football is, you know, they might as well be different sports. And the reality is that the money that's spent on those programs and the system that feeds those programs is so, so massive. And it's just, you know, that's just what it is. But that's not necessarily, you know, that's Alabama, right? That's practically a professional organization, and as is most of the Power Five in the Division I programs. But university sport in Canada and university football in Canada is on par with, you know, Division II, III, other levels of football in the United States. And so, you know, I think that there's, you know, we compare ourselves to that a lot, but the reality is, you know, look at Carleton or Ottawa, some of the best basketball programs in our country, they're beating NCAA Final Four teams in preseason play every year. You know, our best programs in Canada in basketball are not just playing with, but are beating these great, great basketball powerhouses in the United States. And it actually is also true for other sports. Volleyball is another one. McMaster University a few years ago hosted Ohio State for two games, beat them both games, and Ohio State won the national championship in the NCAA that year, and McMaster was the silver medalist in Canada. So there's a lot of other sports where, you know, we are on, you know, a level playing field. There are some, and even though we can maybe be on the level playing field with some of our teams in basketball, you know, they're playing in front of 20,000 people, and, you know, they're obviously the money and the culture behind athletics is just so, so great in the United States that it's a bit of an unfair comparison sometimes. To your question about, you know, is it growing? There's no question it's growing. You know, you look at the facilities that are at Queens today from the time when I graduated, they're incredible. You know, the university just announced, you know, in addition to the football stadium and, you know, there are some outstanding facilities and there's some outstanding athletic programs. And I think we sometimes, you know, don't give that enough attention and enough, you know, positivity for what they actually do.
You mentioned the Carleton thing. Do you ever think maybe March Madness could get big here?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting thing. Once again, it's like March Madness is, you know, one of the largest sport properties on the planet. You know what I mean? It's like they don't get much bigger than that. And the gambling is part of what fuels, you know, and not just gambling, but, you know, picking your bracket when you're not even gambling is, you know, fuels so much of that. The broadcast obviously fuels so much of it. The number of universities in the United States and the affinity for your alma mater drives so much of that. You know, so I'd have a hard time seeing a, you know, a March Madness style system here. We don't have enough schools either, right? I mean, we don't even have the same, we have less 56 universities in Canada. So you don't even have, you know, there's 64 teams.
March Madness. Small bracket.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that over the years, you know, we've seen some great basketball for the Final Eight basketball championships, and they're always broadcast every year and have had great success, whether they've been in Ottawa or out in the East Coast in Halifax for years and years and years. And you know, people come to appreciate the quality of basketball as well, especially as the game's changed, right? And is about more about, you know, 3-and-D and a little more the style of, you know, the Canadian player who maybe isn't a, you know, a big physical specimen that's playing at the rim all the time. So, you know, I think that, you know, I think that once again, this, it's not going to necessarily be what March Madness is, but there's something to like about it. And I think in Canada in general, we have a, you know, we have a tough time appreciating sport for sport, you know, in other parts of the world. And that's like a North American thing. In other parts of the world, people appreciate sport for sport, whether it's Division One, Two, Three. You look at, you know, soccer, and that's a big topic right now. Soccer in Europe, obviously, with the Super League thing that, you know, seems to be falling apart as quickly as it was announced. But people are pissed about that because they believe in, you know, relegation, and they believe in, you know, my small town franchise having a chance to play, you know, the Man U's and Arsenals of the world. And so we don't appreciate sport for sport enough, I don't think.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Just listening to some real soccer fans, especially like some podcasts with people from England specifically, it's almost gutting the way hearing them talk about how crushing it would be for them, even if they cheer for like an Arsenal or a Man U, where it's going the other way, where it's like kind of the big tier. They still want to be able to go to like the pitch that's only holds 2,000 people instead of 100,000. Like, it's still that culture that's built around soccer. It'd be gutting to them for this to go through. I'll admittedly haven't looked into it, and I assume you haven't as well, Jack. We're not the biggest soccer fan, no. But I have been following it just through some of the like sports avenues I follow. And
yes,
I was a soccer player as a kid too. So I can imagine how that would just not be the same game.
Sounds like as recently as this evening, the six Premier League clubs have all pulled out. So it looks like they cut some deals and they satisfied some of the interests, and it seems like maybe all will be well in the future. You know, it's kind of like a Power Five situation in the NCAA, right? Where they kind of flexed their muscle, got what they needed out of the NCAA, and it's always kind of, you know, at just under the surface that, you know, they could force a change. But yeah, a really interesting case study, and not being necessarily like a soccer guy myself, it's interesting to watch from a sport business perspective.
I heard FIFA actually did some good for once by the sounds of things. They're saying maybe possibly international players wouldn't go, which is big for if people aren't going to want to sign on a team that's in the league and if they can't go represent their country, because that's such a big passion. So I heard that was a rumor as well. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. And then, so I guess we talked about your kind of football career at Queens. So from there, obviously it went really well and you did get drafted by the Argos. I see fifth round, 44th overall in 2005. How was that transitioning from university sport to the CFL? Did you play as a rookie? How did that work out? And how did the draft work in the CFL compared to kind of what we're used to in an NHL and NFL?
Yeah, well, yeah, lots to unpack there. I was really fortunate to, playing in the CFL wasn't necessarily like a goal early on. I started playing football really late, like grade 12. I was a hockey player before that and a track athlete. I'd always been a track athlete, but started football late and was just doing it because I enjoyed it and took me to university and I was enjoying it there and didn't start thinking about it as a possibility till late in my career. And was lucky to have a chance to get drafted, kind of an afterthought as a fifth round pick. You're not, you're definitely not at the forefront. But I kind of looked at it like I was, I was in camp, I had a chance to make the team, and that's what I was going to do. I think once you get over that initial, when I arrived in Toronto, it was a really veteran team. It just come off the Grey Cup, and first practice, like I'm taking handoffs from Damon Allen. Mike O'Shea's on the other side of the sideline at the middle linebacker position. Like guys you've watched on TV, pinball's our coach. Like once you get past that surreal kind of experience, and fortunately, I had like a great play, like first practice right off the bat. You're like, yep, I belong here. And you kind of settle in and you get over that. It makes it a little bit easier. The big difference was, I was really lucky. We had a really kind of advanced offensive system at Queens when I was there. And I also played a ton of special teams, which was really important for any young Canadian in the CFL. So I was really comfortable covering kicks and blocking and doing those sorts of things that some guys who maybe just played their offensive or defensive position in university because they were the best player aren't as comfortable with transitioning to. And the style of offense we played was a pro style offense, was a pass oriented offense, a single back offense. So once again, picking up the playbook, which for some guys is the hardest thing. I played with guys from every big time school in the NCAA that you can think of. And some were busters. Some were obviously great. And, some guys couldn't pick up the offense. Some guys, whatever. And so, so that was good. The big difference too is certainly is like everybody's good though. Even the guys that I kind of flippantly say was a buster, like they're awesome athletes. They're fast, they're big. Like, I remember one of our first practice and like the tackle pulls on like a sweep or something, and he is hauling ass. And I'm like, holy crap, I gotta like book it to keep up with this guy. And this is a 320-pound offensive tackle. And that was a bit of a change, obviously, from collegiate football in the CIS. So so those were the things. But I made the team. I actually started out as on the practice roster. But as far as I was concerned, that was good enough. I was on the team, I stayed on the practice roster for about the first half of the season, and which was tough because I could have gone back to Queens, and I thought hard about it for a fifth year, but decided to stick around and see what happens. And glad that I did, because like the next week I got on the roster, the start of the game day roster. And I never came off after that. Not one time after that until the day I retired, 7 years later. And, I was fortunate to have, a really, really long, relatively long career and have some success and a lot of fun along the way. And it was kind of a really cool way to, get started in life and led to my post-football career and working in sport full time.
And I guess clearly it seems like the CFL was a massive part of your life. You said you had a long career. What do you kind of think when you see the state of the CFL now, especially during the pandemic when we can't get fans in the stands? Obviously, it's got to be pretty upsetting. Do you have, if you were kind of put in charge, commissioner of the CFL, what would your next steps be in the next year, as soon as hopefully all this stuff clears up and hopefully they can get some fans back in the stands.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges for the CFL is the perception of the league. And that's always been a challenge. And it kind of relates back to our conversation before. You know, we're compared against the NFL. The NFL is the greatest professional league on the planet. You know, there's some European soccer, obviously, is kind of in that sphere, but the NFL is it. So it's kind of unfair to compare it against the NFL. And that's a difficult thing because that's just the reality. And especially in our big markets, you know, the Torontos, Vancouver's, Montreal's, you know, to lesser extent those, but especially Toronto, you know, we want everything premium. We want to have the best of everything. We want to consider ourselves a world-class city, you know, so NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, NFL. And, you know, that's a challenge in your biggest market, and which is so important for the league with sponsors and television and all that sort of stuff. So the perception's tough. And unfortunately, under the pandemic, the perception has only gotten worse, unfortunately. I think that, you know, one of the big issues with the CFL for its kind of where it lives in the marketplace is like continuity of rosters. You know, the rosters really, when we had a lot of success through kind of the mid 2000s in Toronto, when we were at the Dome, but we were getting 30,000 people a game, and it was good. It was still a high, it was a good ticket and product was good. We had the roster was had pretty good continuity. You know, we had did some flashy things, brought in Ricky Williams and, you know, you did that sort of stuff, but I think continuity of the roster makes a big difference. And unfortunately there's a lot of turnover with American players, with, you know, Canadian players and free agency, all this sort of thing. So I think that's a big challenge, because if you can create stars and people that, you know, your local, you know, the local community can get behind and recognize, that goes a long, long way. Now in the current environment, I understand, you know, where they're going. I understood the CFL 2.0. You've got a aging fan demographic that is, you've kind of maxed out your television, right? You know, television viewership's only going up incrementally year over year. You've kind of a ceiling as to how many people you can put in the stands, 20 to 30,000 people. You kind of max out your sponsorship revenue. So where's your additional revenue going to come? And with that fan base getting older and the younger fan base not consuming sports the same way, where they're not watching the game on television, on TSN, on cable the same way that your parents are, and, you know, the 30 and 40 year olds may still be doing. So you had to diversify, and certainly the global initiative of like finding new markets to sell your product, it made sense. The leap to the XFL is obviously like a big, big leap, but I get it, right? You know, that sort of deal could be a, you know, $100 million television deal, and, you know, a market of, you know, 36 million people here in Canada to sell products to, plus the market in the United States for the US based team. The business case could probably be there. It's just a matter of whether those diehard fans and the fans of the CFL that have kept it alive for so long can buy into whatever theoretical or real change gets proposed. So I'm as interested as anyone to see where that goes, but it's clear that, you know, they've got to figure out, you know, a better business model and a better way to operate. And you know, I think it would be, you know, wouldn't be good business to not explore that possibility. The reality is, you know, the Rock's behind it, but the guy's got, you know, an unbelievable following, an unbelievable, you know, presence. And the, you know, Redbird Capital is as successful, you know, a financial backer as the CFL could ever dream to have. And what they've done from, you know, their work with the Cowboys to the Yes Network to, you know, all these sorts of things they've done in sport, you know, you got to at least hear it out.
And just for those listening who don't know, is it kind of, we'd see it similar to the NHL where you have teams both in Canada and the States? Are teams combining, or is there any propositions on the table, or is it just in the infancy?
Who knows? Only speculation. I mean, the only thing the CFL has officially said, and, you know, that Randy's comment is, we're talking about talking, which, you know, it's not a statement. You know, if you come out with a press release about having conversations, it means you're farther down the path. So everybody knows they're farther down the path, and everybody's dug. And, you know, but there's a lot of speculation. I think some of it is, you know, about a true interlocking league with, you know, 10 Canadian teams, 10 American teams. And, you know, maybe a Major League Baseball style schedule, you know, an American League and a National League kind of playing towards a championship game. You know, I think there's a lot of different, you know, theoretical ideas out there. And until the league comes forward with, you know, some actual plans, you know, we're just all kind of hypothesizing what it could potentially be. If anything, who knows? Maybe it doesn't, you know, materialize into anything. I doubt that, but maybe not.
Yeah. And I know some could disagree with me, but when I look at the Raptors and kind of Dre coming on as the global ambassador, people could say he just got in the way of the players on the sidelines and everything, and he didn't do too much. But really, I think just his following itself did a lot for the Raptors, and people who may not have put the basketball game on before, when they saw he was watching it, I think they did. Do you think that that's kind of the way that the CFL needs to go as well? And does somebody in Canada stick out to you, could be kind of that global ambassador per se?
Well, I mean, absolutely. You know, the Raptors example, and it's funny, people laughed at the Drake, you know, global ambassador thing. And he was like he was an authentic fan and they found a role for him, but it was brilliant. It was brilliant. It brought, you know, a swag to the franchise. You know, it tapped into what it was that they were building at the time. You know, it aligned with the, you know, the Spike Lee at the New York Nets games, Knicks games, excuse me. You know, or Jack Nicholson at the Jack Nicholson at the Lakers games, or you know, that kind of factor of what basketball kind of has. And you know, I think that you know, works for all sports. I mean, we do it at the RBC Canadian Open in terms of having celebrities there and doing celebrity-based events, and you know, and it's more so than ever with social media and social influencers. So you know, I think that obviously it's worked already. You know, The Rock being attached to the CFL has created more chatter for the CFL than maybe it's ever had, and certainly than it's ever had in, you know, March and April. You know, so that, you know, is there a person? Well, why shouldn't it just be The Rock? But, you know, I think there's other people. I think they've got to have they've got to have an affinity for the league, though. Like, you know, Drake is a Raptors fan. He's a Toronto fan. You got to have that same thing with your kind of celebrity endorsers, your celebrity influencers. They've got to be authentic fans, because people, you know, people see through that. If it's not authentic, people know it's bullshit, and they you know, they shy away from it and they don't buy into it.
Definitely. And I guess we'll kind of pivot the conversation, because you brought up two points that we want to go to. Obviously we were talking about basketball, I think we'll start on, but you also brought up the golf side too, which we're excited to get into. As I know, so many people in Canada, especially my age, picked up golf last summer when we were kind of forced to go outside and stay outside, and that was the perfect way to do it. But firstly, we're just curious about your role with Canada basketball and what that kind of entailed, and then maybe a couple follow-up questions after that.
Yeah, so I spent 3 years at Canada basketball. I was recruited from when I was at the OUA. I was recruited to come to Canada basketball and lead all their business operations, domestic development, hosting program, and a variety of things. It was a fairly large portfolio. But really the business ops and organizational development was really the key in the hosting platform. So, you know, I did a whole variety of things, but spent a lot of time running their hosting program and building out a hosting program that really wasn't in existence and was really focused around, you know, building properties you know, for the organization, so that, you know, we could grow the revenue streams and support for the national team. Because at the end of the day, despite the success of basketball and it's exploding, you know, Canada basketball struggled over the years. It's a relatively small NSO, and you know, hasn't established itself, you know, in terms of its business model the same way. You know, I'm really proud of the work that we did, and I think they've kind of really carried on since then. You know, announced a great new deal with Sportsnet, is hopefully going to get the opportunity to host a Olympic qualifier this summer, is going to launch a new U22 event property. So, you know, I think that they're, you know, kind of on the verge of really being able to harness more of the success of basketball in our country, which is unbelievable, is outpacing everything, is outpacing hockey, is outpacing soccer, is really, really on a rocket ship. So that was kind of my role there, you know, working on the business side. Certainly spent a lot of time working with both the men's and women's national teams and all the age levels to run the events that we ran. And it was a lot of fun. And Golf Canada came knocking with that opportunity, kind of once again got recruited, and it was, you know, pretty cool opportunity to go work for, you know, one of the biggest annual sporting events on our calendar in Canada. So, but yeah, basketball is awesome, and it's pretty exciting. Pretty exciting to see what's happening in our country with that sport.
Definitely. It's exciting to see Canadians. I mean, you always have that dream that some of the big ones with the trend of the NBA won't stay on their current team, and some might want to come play at home. So there's always that dream out there that maybe that's going to happen, whether it be, I mean, I don't know why Jamal Murray would want to leave, but one of those guys, Shai Gilgeous or somebody like that, to come home, it'd just be a dream come true to just get that new guy in there. Was there one player that you met, a Canadian basketball player, that kind of stuck out to you as, hey, like this is really genuinely cool?
Yeah, I mean, I had the great fortune to meet, you know, all the guys you just mentioned. Certainly, you know, Steve Nash, of course, was really cool to meet and work with. You know, the program is really quite a family still, and that, you know, a lot of the people that are involved in the program at the various levels were all part of the program previously. You know, I think that, you know, Kelly Olynyk is awesome. Just kind of a West Coast vibe guy. You know, great stories about him taking his skateboarder. He had like a kind of a regular old pickup truck, you know, from his condo, you know, to the arena in Miami. So, you know, he was pretty cool guy and neat guy to get to be around. Corey Joe, of course, and during my time there, he was a Raptor for a lot of that, so he's very obviously kind of front and center in Toronto at the time. You know, getting to see RJ come up and you know, being around that U19 team and being in Egypt and seeing him blossom and is continuing to develop in the NBA. You know, they're all, you know, all good guys. Andrew Nembhard this year, seeing him really center stage with Gonzaga was awesome. He kind of led our U18 team. We hosted the U18 FIBA Championships in St. Catharines back in 2018. And he was the leader of that team. And, you know, he had a difficult medical issue after that, and kind of, I think, slowed down his career a little bit. And, you know, as he was at Florida and then transferred from Florida to Gonzaga and really, you know, blossomed there. So, and we've got just like, it's, you know, and on the women's side, like, you know, Kia Nurse is as good at basketball as anyone is at anything.
Yeah.
You know, and just, you know, that women's program is just humming. They got a real good shot at a medal this summer. They've been building it and building it every year. A bunch of women who are just so dedicated and so passionate about playing for Canada. You know, were awesome to work with when we ran events, would do anything, love the kids, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that women's team is a special group, and it's a young group now. They've had some turnover from kind of the veterans that really established it and took it forward, but tons of young talent coming every year. There's just another player and another guy.
Is there one name that sticks out that the average basketball consumer wouldn't know, but is just like the heart of Team Canada that should get a shout out?
Yeah, probably the next young kind of next superstar probably is a guy named Caleb Houston from Mississauga. He's a five-star McDonald's All-American. He's committed to Michigan. You know, 6'8" power forward, like top five player in this recruiting class, considered to be a lottery pick when he comes out. Went to Montford Academy there in Florida, number one high school basketball team in the country. RJ Barrett, Andrew, both played there. So he's the one that, you know, people will, you know, next year during March Madness, you know, people are going to see, you know, obviously that Michigan team's got something going there, you know, has followed a few other players that have gone to Michigan over the recent years. So that's the guy. Yeah, Caleb Houston is the guy that, you know, I would say to watch out for to be our next NBA star. And, you know, for a while, I was able to say, you know, talk about RJ and then he becomes a superstar. Jamal exploded at the Pan Am Games and that summer. But people really didn't know him. And you'd say like, Jamal's like legit, like he's better than Wiggins. Like, don't worry about it. And people were like, nah. And, you know, I think last year in the playoffs, people saw that, hey, Jamal might actually be a top 10 player in the NBA. You know, he might be just outside of that group, but, you know, he's a top 20 player for sure.
Definitely, and he's Canadian, which is always good to see. Any other questions on the basketball side, Jack, before you want to move on to the golf side? Because I know I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I got one. Who'd you say is, like, the best out of all Canada basketball players, you'd say?
Our best Canadian?
Yeah, who do you have, like, number one?
Jamal?
Yeah. For
sure. Yeah. I mean, Alexander's coming along. You know, he had a really great season last year in OKC. You know, they've had a tougher season this year, but, you know, he's excellent and is only getting better and better. But, you know, Jamal is an elite scorer, and he's got that killer instinct. And it's a real shame that they, you know, to have lost him for this summer in the Olympics. Like, Canada, you know, they got to host. Hopefully we can host the qualifier. You got to get over Greece and Giannis, of course, in that tournament. But with their full roster and the number of guys that, you know, that are planning on playing and being part of that team can absolutely medal at the Olympics. And the way it was set up is Canada would actually be in the same bracket as the U.S., which is actually a really cool thing. They actually get to play each other. Olympics never happened. So how cool would that be to see Canada's, like, golden generation playing, you know, a dream team. And then they would be, you know, separate and wouldn't play each other again till a gold medal. So how awesome would that be to see Canada and the U.S. in a gold medal at the Olympics? So I really hope that, you know, we can get to a place where they can host that event. It's supposed to be out in Victoria at the end of June. And that we, you know, do get, like, our pretty, pretty full roster of NBA players. And there are a few international players as well that, you know, will be in that mix, because we've got some great ones out there that, you know, aren't in the NBA that could earn a spot on that team. So, I gotta go with Jamal. But, man, it's a great time to be a Canadian basketball fan.
Definitely. It's also a good time to be a Canadian golf fan. I know Corey Connors up there in the Masters. He's been playing well lately. Forgive us. We're not the biggest golf experts. I mean, I grew up around golf. My whole dad's side played it. So I've always been on the golf course, and I used to watch it as a kid. But last little bit, I haven't been watching as much sports. I've been stuck at home, and my mom and my sister don't love when I throw on sports all day, like if I was away at school or something like that. So I haven't been watching as much lately. But that being said, how happy would you must have been when the rise of golf was huge last year, especially in the youth? I know Jack would be a testament to it. I always was trying to find people, say, maybe 4 years ago to get a foursome going, and it was difficult. But last summer, everyone was looking to play. So that must have put a smile on your face.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was unfortunate, you know, what I spend, you know, my year focused on, the Canadian Open, you know, didn't happen. But it was, as you said, a banner year for golf in our country. Record rounds every single month of the season last year, record numbers of scores being posted, like growth in participation last year. Incredible. And you're right. And not just kind of the core, you know, golf fan. It was really diversifying. Younger golfers, women golfers, people from diverse communities. And we've really tried to lean into that and really open the door to make golf more accessible for people. We launched First Tee Canada and are in our launching chapters this year that is really aiming to, you know, removing barriers to participation, allowing more kids to be part of the sport. So you know, it was a great time, and we were able to show that, you know, golf had some inherent advantages. You know, four people hit on the 150 acres is kind of naturally socially distanced. So, and depending on how good of a golfer you are, you might even be more socially distanced if you're in the rough or in the woods all the time. But, you know, it was, and I think it will be again this year. It certainly started this way here in Ontario. You know, we unfortunately have to have a little pause on it. But, you know, I think we'll come roaring back, and, you know, the tee sheets will be full, and, you know, I think I've got 9 rounds in already this year.
Yeah. I think I played 6. They cut us off last weekend though. It was like breaking up with a girlfriend without any closure. Like, they announced it Friday, had the tee times booked for Saturday and Sunday, and you couldn't go. Like if they would at least gave me my last Saturday round, it would have felt a little better. Get out there with dad and the neighbors and everything would be happy. But no, it was cut right off on Friday. So it was definitely tough. I know at work we went in on Monday. A lot of my friends are golfers and they were not, it was not a good Monday after that. That's for sure.
So I've got some green space, like a big park and forest space behind my house. So we get in and hit into the park and into the forest quite a bit. But I built a big hitting bay in my backyard. So I got a big hitting net, big piece of turf, the whole bit. So it's like a permanent installation. So we can get out there and knock them into the net kind of over the next couple of weeks to try to scratch our itch. But it's been great. I have 8-year-old twins and a younger daughter as well. But my 8-year-old twins got really into the game last year and are really into it this year. So we played a couple times last week and, you know, they'll do some camps and stuff this year. But, you know, the cool thing about it is that it really is truly, you know, a sport for life. Unlike really almost pretty much any other sport. You know, you can play it when you're 8, you can play it when you're 98. And it really can be for everybody. So it's pretty cool. And you mentioned earlier the PGA Tour. I mean, we've got, you know, a record number of guys on the tour, 8 guys on the tour right now. You know, Corey is leading that group, has been unbelievable this year. You know, has been top 10s, top 20s every time out. Really fantastic. Mackenzie Hughes from Dundas, Ontario, had a fantastic end of the season last year. FedEx Cup, 14th of the FedEx Cup, so awesome year. You know, Adam Hadwin's been fantastic for quite a long stretch. Nick Taylor is one on tour, one last year on tour. You know, and all those guys are really the result of, you know, Mike Weir winning at the Masters and having a 5-year run of dominance. Like, most people only think of Mike as winning at the Masters, but he was dominant in a time when Tiger was the most dominant and when golf was really at an apex. And all those guys got inspired to be, you know, professional golfers. And we've got a young group of, you know, Roger Sloan, Taylor Pendrith, Adam Svensson that are coming up, that are in the Korn Ferry Tour and are playing on the PGA Tour off and on, and are like the next wave of guys that are going to join those ranks. And, you know, I'd be remiss not to, you know, mention Brooke Henderson, you know, our greatest professional golfer. You know, most wins, professional wins, won the CP Women's Open a couple years ago out in Saskatchewan, is a major winner, is, you know, one of the greatest female golfers on the planet, could have a real good shot at a medal at the Olympics. And we've got a number of other young players. Alana Sharp, as the veteran on tour, has had a long, illustrious career on tour. We've got a good group of young players coming up behind them as well. So it really is a great time for golf. And, you know, we had 2019 for us for the Open, but both Opens, the men's and the women, but certainly the men's, we had a record year in every aspect. You know, we've diversified. We had the best field we'd had in years, if not ever. We added cool elements. We had 25,000 people attend 2-night concert series. You know, we had Florida Georgia Line play a concert for 15,000 people on the first hole of the East Course in Hamilton. Like, we did some really cool things that really have made golf, you know, more accessible and opened us up to new audiences. So, you know, the pandemic sucked for us. It sucks for everyone. And we're excited to get back to it, hopefully next year in 2022.
I think in our age group too, Mike Weir was definitely the pioneer that we witnessed when we start to remember sports, for sure. And it just shows, I mean, obviously you can say it firsthand, but me as a casual fan, seeing him hit that shot into the water on, what was it, like 16 to miss the cut. And then the next day he's on TSN broadcasting. It's like, that's got to be a tough pill to swallow, but it just kind of shows the commitment to Canadian golf and broadcasting with TSN. So yeah, totally. It's really good to see.
Weirzy's been, you know, Weirzy's, you know, he's 50, 51 now, but has actually been fantastic on the Champions Tour now. Has been in the hunt for a couple times, you know, to win Champions Tour's events. And, you know, he'll play at the Canadian Open as long as he wants to. You know, he's a, you know, borderline Mount Rushmore of Canadian sports guy. And his win at the Masters is a, you know, I would argue is a top 5 sport moment in Canadian sports. So, you know, it's we're lucky to have, you know, guys like that. And hopefully one of those other young guys we talked about will be the next one to win the Masters and ideally win the Canadian Open.
Definitely. Has it been, what, 50 years since a Canadian has won?
Oh, we're like 60.
60?
64.
I wrote it down somewhere here, but I can't find it, of course.
Yeah, and I should know it off the top of my head, but it's been too long to know it off the top of my head.
Since the 50s. But Pat Fletcher?
Yeah, yeah. One of those guys is going to win it in the near future. I have like all the confidence. We had 26 Canadians tee it up in 2019. Record number of Canadians at the RBC Canadian Open. Hadwin, McKenzie, we're all in the mix that year to Rory kind of ran away with it, but they're there. Got Canadians are up to the leaderboard almost every week, and certainly recently with Corey every single week.
Yeah, for sure. I know you mentioned Florida Georgia Line, which we were going to talk about, but what are some other ways that you're trying to get people to go and actually watch the tournament itself? Is it true that there's like a hockey hole? I've never went to the tournament, but I keep seeing that online. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first thing is we got to get you out next year. So that's a mandatory requirement now that you guys get out to the tournament. We have the rink hole. And the rink hole was actually, the PGA Tour gives out awards every year. And the rink was named the best element on tour. And so what it is essentially we surround, we theme the hole, a par three hole, all around hockey. We put boards all around the hole, around the tee. The marshals are in referee jerseys. There's a Zamboni. We do all this sort of stuff. Guys wear hockey jerseys, throw stuff into the crowd. We have hospitality and fans and everything around there. People lean over the boards and bang the boards for great shots. Like, it's us building, a fan element that's fun. That's a kind of a tribute to Canadiana. It's stealing a little bit of that magic that, Waste Management has down in Arizona at their 16th stadium hole. And every year it's grown. And since 2007 when it was introduced, 2017 when it was introduced. And it's going to be, as soon as we get to do this thing at St. George's, it's going to be twice as big as it was even at 2019. So that's a cool element. And I think something that brings a lot to the tour and brings a lot to our event. We added a massive food festival in 2019. We did like 36,000 meals out of this food festival featuring like local restaurants. You could get, you could get a burger, you could get poutine, you get wood oven pizza, like cool food. These sorts of elements, the celebrity elements that we talked about that are taking part in the tournament, playing in the pro-ams, coming out, that sort of thing. And then the concert series. And, what that did was it did exactly what we intended. We intended to get people to come out to the event that had never been before. And we had 15,000 people attend the concert that night, 25,000 people attended the day. So we had 25,000 people on site that day. 15,000 of them were there for the concert, but just over 4,000 showed up after golf ended. So of the 15,000 people that were there for the concert, only about 4,000 of them just came for the concert. The rest came earlier in the day and took in the golf. And kind of anecdotally, posts on Instagram or Twitter or what have you, and stories you hear about, the father-daughter coming together. The daughter's never been to a golf tournament. The father's never been to a country concert, and they came and did it together. And we saw it in our demographics. We flipped. We were like 50-50 men to women. We were like a third millennials, a third Gen Xers, a third boomers. Like it was a really, really successful initiative, and we had intended to bring it back in 2020. Keith Urban was going to headline as well as the Chainsmokers. Obviously, we weren't able to do it, but we intend to bring it back as soon as possible, hopefully in 2022, and really make it kind of part of what we were doing. And we themed the whole event around golf, food, and music. Those kind of became our pillars, and we declared that summer was open with the Canadian Open, that we were, the first week of June, kind of the beginning of festival season, kind of like the X closes the summer in Toronto. We kind of see ourselves as kicking it off and really just marketing to, a diverse group of fans and sports entertainment enthusiasts that want to get out there and be part of a cool, cool event.
Three best things in life. The three you said there, so can't complain about that. And if my dad's listening, he's gonna be mad because I've definitely been to the Canadian Open before. Like I used to go a bunch as a kid, but I just haven't been in the last couple of years. So, gotta say that as well.
All right. Well, there you go. But now it's a different deal now. So
yeah,
we'll see you at St. George's. St. George's in 2022.
Anything else you wanted to ask on the golf side, Jack? I know you're picking up the sport. You're not as close to it, but it must be pretty cool to just see how, I mean, I guess in the last couple of years, we think of going to like a Veld or something like that mm-hmm. when we're a bit younger and a bit less wise, but hey, going to the Canadian Open sounds a lot more fun than doing that nowadays. So I think I've been sold by Brian.
Awesome. Now that's the thing. Like, it's a cool experience for whether you're a hardcore golf fan, whether you're just a casual sports fan. It's a neat experience. It's a different kind of experience too. Like, there are some barriers that we've had to try to remove for those of you that, you know, for Jack, if you've never been to a golf tournament, it's like, it's not like going to a soccer game or a baseball game, basketball. You got your ticket, you go find your seat, you sit down, you watch everything. Yeah. You know, you get a ticket and your stadium is 150 acres, you know, or more. And you've got, you know, miles of front row seats and you can watch it in so many different ways. You can set up and camp out at a hole or a green or a tee. You can walk with a group. You can, you know, and you can really, you know, you're outdoors, you're drinking a beer, you're having food, you're watching some of the best players in the world, you know, like there's lots of fashion, you know, people look good at a golf tournament. And then we've added these other kind of cool elements that, you know, are a lot of fun. So it's a different kind of experience. And I think that, you know, we started to crack the code a little bit and opening it up to other people, you know, seeing bachelor parties like crazy, seeing bachelorette parties like crazy. And it's, and I'll tell you what, I challenge anybody to find a more, you know, a better deal in sport. You know, we were $85 last year. You got to see PGA Tour, you got to see a concert. Florida Georgia Line, closest place they played to Toronto last year was Darien Lake, and tickets were like $300. So, you know, we were an amazing deal, and we focus on families too. It's free under 12. So find a sporting event where your ticket for your kids is free. So, you know, I think that we offer a really great deal for a family, for a young person, for anyone really, when it comes to that. And for those that want to, you know, a little bit more premium, a little more exclusive, we've got all that too, you know, but it's a lot of fun. So
thank you for coming on for an hour. You told about your football career, your careers in basketball and golf as well. Maybe we'll end the podcast off. Do you have one kind of token story that you always tell, kind of your proudest moment, whether it be all the way back to university, something in your professional career, just something you always like to tell over a campfire?
Man, what's the most appropriate story that I can actually share? So,
we're not the most appropriate people.
We can pause.
I've got a reputation to uphold. You know, we had an awesome time at Queens, and, you know, obviously tons of stories from then, but, you know, I had a really neat experience in, and I've been really fortunate to have some amazing experiences in sports, and, you know, I've met a lot of cool people, and I met a couple prime ministers through sport, and I had better tickets than Stephen Harper for the Grey Cup in 2011. So that was pretty cool. I was sitting like a row in front, right in front of him. But, you know, I mentioned earlier, I played with Ricky Williams in 2006. And Ricky Williams at the time is arguably like one of the most notable athletes on the planet. Like, you know, Tiger at that time, of course, and there were, you know, others, but, you know, Ricky was like, you know, he was kind of it. He'd come off 60 minutes, had done the whole, you know, obviously the marijuana issues with the NFL. And so he came up here while he was suspended and played with us. And we formed a good friendship. And he came back to Hamilton with me after practice one day. We had like a party that night at the owner's house or something. And so he wanted to get like a new outfit. And so we go to Limeridge Mall in Hamilton with Ricky Williams. And we're walking around the mall, probably like 40 minutes, you know, no one's bugging us, no one knows us, whatever. And he's looking for like, you know, a green golf shirt and like a pair of shoes to match his green golf shirt or something. And we go into like Champs and Foot Locker and all these stores looking for shoes. And we get into this, I think it was Champs, and like the manager recognizes him and says some stuff to him. And Ricky's like, pretty shy guy. Like he was a, like legitimately kind of a shy guy and didn't like the attention. And so we leave and we go walking out, and the manager like comes running out after us with this like handful of Texas Longhorn hats. And he's like, Ricky, will you sign me? So he grabbed them off the shelf at the chance and he goes running out there. And so Ricky's like, oh, okay. So he's signing these. And I swear to God, it was like they announced it over the PA system. And it was like, woof, and everybody just like surrounded Ricky and you know, asking for autographs and everything. And I'm kind of like, you know, pushed out to the back. You know, I'm kind of like a really unopposing guy, like just like, who, you know, nobody knows me. And I think, like, honestly, I was like, it was kind of my first experience with that kind of level of celebrity. And I've certainly been able to be around Tiger a little bit here and there, you know, not, you know, a very close relationship or anything like that, but see it with him, of course. But what that level of like fandom and kind of celebrity status was, and he's like, just like, he's giving me the, like, get me out of here. Like, we got to go. And I'm like, excuse me, guys. We got to, like, Ricky, let's go. And we run out of the mall basically and get the hell out of there. And, you know, I kind of got a little kind of taste into what, you know, what it was like for him. And not something that you really want to live like. And, you know, it was a tough, every year, every building we went into, people were all over him. We were in BC and a guy behind our bench had like a like 5 foot long, like 4 foot around paper mache joint that he's holding over his head like the Stanley Cup, yelling, Ricky, can we smoke this after the game? Like, we're on the sidelines, like, you know, trying not to laugh, and like you hear it and you're just trying not to laugh. It was crazy. Like, we were in Saskatchewan and the entire section behind the bench, like 200 people, every person in that section had a bag of Cheetos, and they're all waving the Cheetos. Ricky, are you hungry? Like, it was tough. So anyway, that was kind of that was a surreal experience to be around him, but he was an awesome teammate, worked hard, was a really kind guy. And it was pretty cool to have him part of the team for that year. So, you know, anyways, not the craziest, but definitely a PG family story that we can tell.
I'd say it's one of the best we've heard when we asked that question. No, Jack.
Yeah. The best, actually. The big joint's a great story.
Oh, the paper mache, it was a thing of beauty, and hilarious. Like the guy just like holding it up like the Grey Cup behind our back. Oh man. Yeah. He was, you know, he was an interesting dude. That's for sure.
I'd be remiss. I know we're getting close to the end here, but if I didn't ask you this, I'd regret it. How was your experience like with Tiger? Like, did you talk to him one-on-one? I know you said it was only brief, but that must've been a pretty surreal moment.
No. I've only ever had a chance to kind of meet him in a group setting and kind of say hello that way. You know, I get to travel to a lot of the PGA Tour events and to talk to agents and players and recruit and do those sorts of things, and also see the other events, have meetings, meet with colleagues, that kind of thing. You know, his time is, you know, as demanded at all times. And it's, you know, for those that have seen, you know, saw the documentary this past year, like, I think you get a pretty good insight into, you know, what that could be like. And you know, I don't know that it's something anybody would really actually desire if they actually knew what it was really like. So like, it's a kind guy to me, like not someone I know, you know, personally or anything like that, but definitely have had a good chance to forge some good relationships with some of the other guys on the tour and get to know them a bit, and some fantastic guys. Rory's awesome guy, can't chug a beer for anything. he pulled like an Aaron Rodgers. Remember that video, Aaron Rodgers at the basketball?
Oh yeah, the basketball game.
Yeah, he pulled one of those after 2019. We had our champions reception and I gave him the beer and everyone's like, oh, yeah, cheer him on, chug it. And he gave like the I can't do it.
I'll do it later.
I feel like that's like kind of off brand too. We wouldn't want to be seen in public not being able to chug a beer, I'd say.
Good dude though, really good dude.
I think at this point, you just told those awesome stories, so that's the perfect way to cap it off. But maybe we'd like to just throw it to you. I know you kind of promoted the Open before, but is there anything else that you want to promote from your side for anyone listening? I know most of the people are listening around our age, so about 25 years old, so just maybe some propaganda to get them out to the Open.
Yeah, more propaganda to get them out to the Open. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know what? It's give it a shot if you haven't before. And it's pretty, it's a fun day. It's a long, it's like I said, that you go, you can be there the whole day. That's the other thing too, right? It's not just, you know, a 3 hour, $300 for 3 hours to go to the, go to a Leaf game or something. It's, you can make a whole day of it. And it's a pretty cool experience to be outside and, having a beer in your hand and walking around and seeing all the sights and so give it a shot if you get a chance. And, thanks for having me on tonight, guys. It's been a lot of fun. Always good to connect with Queens alum and an honorary Queens alum.
Thank you.
Jack, you want to say your thank yous that we'll sign off?
Yeah, no, thank you so much for being on here, man. It was great talk.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we'll do it again sometime for sure.
Hey, we'll hold you to that. We love that stories at the end. So they were awesome to hear it. And thanks again. And we'll definitely be getting our friend group out to the Open next summer. Just as a thank you for helping on the podcast.
Sounds good, buddy. St. George's June 6th, 2022 is the tournament week. So there's stuff every single day, and Friday, Saturday, Sunday are, awesome days. So we'll see you there.
Awesome. Thanks again for hopping on. We really appreciate it. Thanks to everyone for listening as well. Take it easy. Peace.